Session number 9796.
Mr. Spearman, reel 5.
Yes, these pillboxes on the beach in Normandy when we land on D-Day were not like the guns of Singapore, which were only built and mounted to face out to sea. And when the Japs came down from North Malaya, they were unable to turn round and use them in that direction. On the beach at the second front, they had all-round fire. Anyhow, I continue to say that our one object there was to get off the killing ground, off the beach. And it was difficult to do because we'd never really been on a beach which was so heavily defended on a other raid. We'd landed early in the morning, silently, hopefully without the knowledge of being there, and all the surprise was on our side. But here at Dieppe, it was open warfare, and there was a beach which was covered in every direction by flamethrowers, by machine guns, by howitzers, by mortars. All the weapons that the Germans had were positioned as to be able to bring to bear all the fire on any point of the beach they wanted to. Anyway, we got off the beach, and just beyond the beach was the road. Now, our objective, number four commander's objective, was to turn left and go east along that road through Wiestringham, which was nearby, and then beyond Wiestringham, to the east of Wiestringham, there was a gun battery. And our first objective was to knock this gun battery out of action. This wasn't an easy approach. It was a very difficult approach because it wasn't a question of street fighting, but we had to go through the streets of Wiestringham, or the outskirts of Wiestringham, and we were under constant sniper fire the whole way. No frontal assaults on us, no tanks. I don't remember tanks. There may have been one or two tanks, but personally I didn't get involved with tanks. But going down these long streets on the way to this thing, I do remember vaguely being under mortar fire. And as I've said before, the Germans were particularly good at mortar fire. And all the way along this approach, you'd have snipers firing at you. And by the time you heard the crack, it was too late. You couldn't really take evasive action from snipers other than to zigzag and to go behind any car or any lamppost on your way down. You couldn't stop. There's no point in stopping. You had to go on. With the mortar bombs, they were very frightening, of course, as always. You'd hear the and then just before that loudest pitch that it reaches, just before it goes, you've got to throw yourself on the ground. You had to throw yourself on the ground. You had to keep stopping for that. And if you didn't throw yourself quick enough, you could be hit by the shrapnel. And I remember on one occasion a very good friend of mine who was just in front of me, we were working in conjunction, you know, down, you know, telling each other just, you know. On this particular occasion, he was just a fraction slower than me going down. And when I got up, he never got up, I turned him over and he had shrapnel on his head. He'd killed outright. Chap called Burroughs, very nice, inoffensive young man. But there you are. And this reiterates, really, it was just a question of your reaction, the quickness of your reaction. It wasn't a question of... Lord Lovett was always extremely bold and brave, and it would take a lot for him to take cover, but in the end he got wounded, and I think it was for this reason that he did get wounded. If he'd have been a little bit more cowardly like we were and gone down, I think he could have avoided his wounds that he got in the end. But anyhow, I say, the approach to this battery, it was quite frightening. And I was C troop, and there were two or three other troops on the same operation, all making their way to this gun battery. And the one thing that sticks in my mind is this chap Burroughs getting killed when this mortar bomb came over. But this continued on all the way down, and it was quite a frightening time. I don't think it lasted more than an hour, this approach. And when we eventually got there, I don't remember too much about this gun battery. I wasn't really involved too much in this knocking this gun battery out. We got inside the enclosure, shot a couple of Germans myself, and there were other Germans lying around. But I think one of the other troops had done the great donkey work on the guns themselves, because before I knew it, it didn't go on for as long as, say, the gun battery at Dieppe. Before I knew it, we were on our way back, because then we had another destination. Meanwhile, the other commanders who had landed on our beach after us, they were already making their way inland. So our job now was to do this same approach after we put this gun battery out. And My vague memory after this gun battery at Wiestringer was making our way inland to our destination, Hauger, and we got shut up. We made an approach. I was just simply one of the bodies there with these very heavy weights, and every hour we'd stop for 5 minutes. And eventually we got to the River Orme and what is now known as Pegasus Bridge. This is the point where the paratroopers who made up the Thin Red Line, where we, the commandos, linked up with the paratroopers on this bridge, now called Pegasus Bridge. And Lord Lovett is reputed, and I know now, to have had a piper with him. And these pipes were brought out, and as we came up to Pegasus Bridge, I remember the bridge very well, and I remember there wasn't a lot of fire, but there was a lot of sniping going on. So if you expose yourself, you're at great risk. But Lovett went up with his piper playing a tune and apologised to the paratroopers for being 2 minutes late. I never saw that happen, but this is written in the history books. So it is the sort of thing he would do, of course. Where he produced the piper from, God only knows. But this is what he did, because I know since then on reunions, that piper, Mullins perhaps his name is, he's done the walk from the beach right up to Pegasus Bridge when they've gone back there. Anyway, so there was number four commando with who came in first in these steel boats, got off the beach. We knocked out the battery at Wiestringham. A lot of skirmishes to Wiestringham and a lot of skirmishes out to Wiestringham. And here we arrived on the bridge over the River Orme, only 2 minutes behind schedule. So I think this is one of the things that Lovett and number four commander were very strict on, is keeping to time, doing everything. Everybody had individual jobs, every body worked. It, no matter who was killed, the rest of the people could all get on. We were like a machine, really. Nothing was going to stop us. I wouldn't have thought so. We were so wound up, we felt we could tackle anything. And if you read about the Dieppe raid and this Pegasus Bridge, you'll read about one officer called Mercer Wilson or something his name was. He was killed by a sniper going across the bridge. But in actual fact, I don't think the man was killed by a sniper at all. To get across this bridge, if you went across the bridge in the ordinary way, you were under severe sniper fire. And what we did, we decided to wade across the river, go down the bank, the slippery bank, and up the other side, rather than expose ourselves to wherever the snipers were. And this particular officer, he was being given a lift up the slippery slope, and he offered this rifle butt to whoever was yanking him up with a safety catch off, and the thing cocked. A bloody stupid thing to do. He wasn't a very experienced officer, but he was a very nice fellow. And he handed up the rifle for his colleague to drag him up, and of course the bloke grabbing the butt automatically put his finger in, the trigger went off and killed the bloke. In the records it said he was killed by a sniper, so as far as the family is concerned, I suppose this is a nicer way as any way to put it. I remember that horrified me, that. What a stupid damn thing to do. Anyway, we got over the bridge, which since the war had become a very historic bridge because of the Lord Lovett apologised for being two minutes late, and this is true. But a lot hinged on this bridge being captured, and before we got there the paratroopers more or less captured it, although it was still under fire. So the bridge was made safe, and when we got there this ensured the safety of that bridge, and a lot hinged on this. Anyway, I don't know how long we stayed there. We then continued our march to wherever we were going, a place called Hauger, I think, Hauger. And we had skirmishes all the way along, got under fire at various times. I can't remember coming under tank fire at all, but what I do remember seeing, horrified to see, at which point we saw these, I can't remember, where the glider force landed. Fields and fields of big, huge, empty, carcassy-looking, coffin-like construction, which were gliders, where all the men inside had left and gone, these empty gliders, all way and every way, nose into the ground and tail up in the air, lying on their backs, lying on the side, mangled together. And it made you realise the horrifying circumstances that those glider people must have been in when they landed like that. What a tremendous chance you take. It's all right to be gliding in England, going around the fields, especially with modern planes, completely under control. It's easy. But to go in force in an occupied territory into fields which were obviously good landing spots, were heavily defended by girders and iron things sticking out of the ground and that sort of thing, to go there after it all happened and see all the empty shells, you wonder and you were mystified how anybody really could escape from it. And when you think that people driving those gliders were really only sergeants, just ordinary sergeants. They weren't, you normally look upon a flyer in the war as being an officer type material, a good educator and that sort of thing, but these were just sergeants. They had a tremendous responsibility of them to have 30 or whatever it was, men in each glider, and they were responsible for not only locating the landing point in dark or in bad weather or whatever, but then to get them safely down in a condition to start fighting, you know. This was a horrific scene to see that. I mean, now looking back, I mean, I know the paratroopers were landed because of the situation in completely wrong positions. People were lost completely on it. And if I refer back to the parachute course that we went on, in case we were to liaise with the paratroopers on this particular operation, they did ask for volunteers to go with this particular parachute regiment in order to liaise with us when they tied up, as I'd explained originally when we went on the course. I personally didn't volunteer, but there were volunteers who went, I think. Maybe only two men, maybe more, but I know one captain fella went, and he took his Batman with him. So they're the two people I know that went. They were landed in completely the wrong position. We know that from matter word, you know, this is actual fact. And they eventually made their way back to the unit, except the captain got killed on the way. But the rider, the Batman, he did come back to us. So even with all that talking about liaison with the airborne division, the people who did go on that liaison, which was long intended and long spoken about, it was all a waste of time because they were dropped in the wrong place. And as for the paratroopers, I don't know personally about them, but we know that a lot of them were dropped in the wrong place as well. Things went wrong with them right from the start. They made it good for it afterwards. But getting back to number four commander, we, after the bridge, the Orme Bridge, we eventually made our way, I don't know how long it took us, but we got to Orme, to this Hawger. And our instructions were then, because we were the actual extreme left or the extreme east defending of the whole of the landing in France, we were the people defending the left-hand portion and we had no reserves. And we were a commando. Our skill was assault landings, a quick scurry and a raid, knock off a few Germans and get away quick. This was our big thing. And here we are now, going to be in a defensive position for God knows how long. It wasn't really our type of war, but this was our appointment this time. And I remember our instructions were there to dig in. And when I think about the labour I put in my garden here, and now the older I get, the less able I feel like digging anything. In any case, we got sandy soil, you shouldn't dig it. But all we had there was these little spade-like things which you hang from your belt, a rather big blade with a short handle. And we had to dig in that night in this place before the Germans got onto us and started attacking. We had to get ourselves build a firing pit, and from the firing pit then dig underground and make a sleeping thing. We turned miners over leaf. It was when I think back on that, it's extraordinary that we were able to do it. But anyhow, we did. We dug. We were extremely tired by this time. The other commandos had arrived in their position earlier than us because we had to do that battery and they didn't. So we were late coming, but then we had to dig ourselves in that night. And I can't remember anything happening that night particularly. I'm very hazy about day-to-day what happened here. All I know is, and I emphasise it, we were the left-hand side of the whole invasion force. And we had to stop anything coming down. And we were abutting the sea. From the sea to our position, it was wasteland and bog. And it was thought unlikely that anything could get along that place. But we were on a crossroad which we had to defend at all costs. And we weren't attacked like that. My memory tells me that we, apart from the firing pits in which we were able to overlook the ground in front of us, to pick the best position available along this hedge, we then had to make ourselves beds. And halfway down the trench, maybe a couple of feet down, we'd dig in and make a long 6-foot trench underneath the ground in which we could sleep. A claustrophobic thought, really, when you think about it. I couldn't do it now. And we used to smoke in there and everything, which was a good thing because it kept the mosquitoes, a lot of mosquitoes around. We had one nasty experience I remember well there. A chap called Waddington, a friend of mine, was in this bunker one night and there was some petrol or something around which they used to do the cooking with. And somewhere or another, during a course of smoke, and this caught light, and of course he was absolutely disfigured with the burns. That was a catastrophic thing happened in a situation like that. And the chap's name was Waddington. I often remember, wonder what happened to him. He's an extremely good-looking fellow, but this is how it normally happens. Anyway, we built in these bunks there beside the bed, and as the time went on, we started getting shelled, and we started getting forays of Germans coming over, and the thing began to get rougher and tougher with all the mortar fire. I could go back again, the moaning minutes and the mortar. The Germans were very good at it. We began then to put cover over our trenches. And I do believe somebody reminded me last year that I think it was Lovett came along and he decided we were getting far too bloody comfortable building ourselves all these underground houses, that he put a stop to it. He'd only let us go a certain point, you know what I mean? Anyway, here we were, the invasion was over, we were in, we'd reached the line where we intended to be, and now it was a question of defending and stopping any Germans coming through. And as a sniper and in charge of the snipers, one of my jobs was to reconnoitre the area, get familiar with the enemy's positions, and also to take point in night reconnaissance patrols. During the daytime, you'd get shelled, you'd get sniped at, and this sort of thing. We could live with this. It wasn't our kettle of fish. And in the end, of course, we were there for almost 3 months. I think it was 84 days or something before we actually got pulled out. So we were in action non-stop for almost 3 months. Not in action all, but yeah, we were in those trenches and on the offensive for almost 3 months. Two or three things I remember distinctly that happened there, which I may as well just tell you about. One was I was a night bird as well as a day bird. Every day, I don't know about every day, but I used to go out, and in Canada, fields are tremendous, they're prairies, there's no hedges or anything, but in France, in Normandy, my memory of it was the hedges were very, very close to each other. There are no large fields. Some of them were bigger than others, but I remember the fields being very small. And so if you wanted to go out from your own positions and go on a recce out to the enemy positions, you made your way along the hedges. From hedge to hedge, and there were certain parts where the hedge or the Germans were likely to be were quite a long way away, and I used to deliberately expose myself on the way out to, at various places, so that if they were on the alert or if they were in a position, they would let fire at me. In that way, I felt at least I would know where they were, and they were less likely to hit me then as they would be when I approached their position. That was a thing I used to take a chance on. I thought it was a well worth chance, because going along these hedges to make your way out to the front, in front of your positions, the Germans, of course, knew what we were doing, and they started booby-trapping the hedges. So apart from the nervity or the excitement or the tension of going out in front of your own position, not knowing whether you were going to bump into one of their patrols or if things had changed, was quite hairy. there was a certain thrill to it all. You're inclined to get a little bit overconfident sometimes, and we became very clever then in locating these booby traps which were put in the hedges. Some of the booby traps, incidentally, weren't to kill, but they were to set off flares. I suppose they were put there really not as a killing device, but as a sort of a warning device of patrols, because of a night time we used to do reconnaissance and fighting patrols of a night time. So the hedges were booby-trapped and flared from a German's point of view for their own advantage, not necessarily just to kill somebody like me just sniping out in the daytime. Anyway, this went on a lot. It's quite a nerve-wracking time because there's no end to it. It wasn't a quick raid and a foray and come away. We were there for 3 months. There was no end to it. As the war went on, Caen was the big city in front of us, and this was a pivot about where the British Army didn't seem to make much progress there, and the Americans, who'd had a terrific time, terrible time landing, had got themselves in a position, and as the time went on, the general there, forget his name for the moment, he was very anxious to make a sweep and to advance forward. They were like this. Montgomery, who we had, give him his due, he never wanted to put his troops at risk unnecessarily. So he wasn't prepared to move from our defensive position until he had everything ready. Quite right, in my opinion, because in the First World War, they just told you to fix bloody bayonets and go, and they used to lose people by the thousands, literally. Montgomery was the exact opposite of that, so we respected him for that. But the Americans were anxious to go. They'd established their beachhead, they got themselves established, and they wanted to go, and Bradley was the thing, and he fell out with Montgomery because Bradley wanted to go and he wanted more petrol, more this and more that, you know, so he could get going it. But why should the British Army be stuck in a heavily defended position and get the worst of the bloody fighting while the American made hay and swept on? That was from my point of view, I used to say to myself, but I think the point was all due to them. You know, give the Americans their due, they had the right spirit and wanted to go, but it went out from Montgomery's point of view, it would unbalance the situation until he was ready. But I do remember when they did eventually sweep forward, before Caen fell, I think, that we went down to the Falaise Gap where the Germans were retreating, and we were horrified. We saw main or secondary roads down which the German army had fled. And it's in my mind now, seeing a whole road, as far as the eye could see, fairly straight road, and all the dead horse-drawn traffic, all the dead horses with carts and that, all lying on either side of the road, riddled and absolutely riddled with maggots over everything. This was a thing I got familiar with too on my sniping and my recce patrols out front. In some of those areas where the paratroopers had landed, I told you originally they weren't landed, they weren't dropped in the right position. We'd often come across the bodies of paratroopers, obviously been dropped in the wrong position, who'd been shot, and were just lying in the fields. In other words, you'd be crawling through a field, making for a position. It may be a cornfield or whatever, or just an ordinary meadow. And suddenly you'd smell this smell of death, this rotting flesh getting nearer and nearer, and you go and investigate, or you wouldn't go and investigate, you just come across a body. And one thing about it, which I'd never really been conscious of before in my life, was the body was nothing really but maggots. The whole thing was crawling. Maggots can apparently come to where there's nothing. They just come from nothing, you know. And, it's terrible to see it. And the smell was absolutely terrible. The whole of Normie in that area smelt of death. It became a smell I was familiar with. And now when I walk around the woods in Surrey, I smell the smell of foxes very strongly. Less and less over the last few years because of all the buildings are going on now and all the wood now being taken away. But the smell of foxes is a very, very strong smell in the woods. Over there, the air was pervaded everywhere I went on my patrols by the smell of death. And it was nearly always our own people, our paratroopers, who'd lain there since they were dropped, you know, 2 or 3 weeks or more beforehand, and now we're actually covered in maggots.
What kind of success as a sniper did you have?
Well, not a great deal. I suppose I must have shot about four or five Germans only as sniping at them. They'd
In
appear
Normandy?
In Normandy, yes. They'd appear in the hedge. I mean, they often knew where you were, but if you could get into a position where you could see them working behind this hedge, one particular hedge I'm thinking of. You waited long enough, somebody would come there and he had a mirror attached to a tree and he'd start combing his hair, or he'd do recognisable things which you know you would be doing yourself. And I didn't like doing it a lot of times, but they were the sort of people I sniped at and shot. You knew if you hit your target. You never knew if you killed them or not, but you knew if you hit the target because they dropped. If you shot, they'd disappear anyway, but they'd drop in a different way if you shot them. The worst things, the most frightening things, though, in my mind, I'm an individual, so I liked sniping. I like going out on these patrols. I like going carefully and locating these booby traps, and I often had somebody with me, the intelligence officer or some other body wanted to come. And to them, it was always a thrill to come out sniping. Because the excitement of being on your own and not knowing the territory and finding a booby trap and then pointing the Germans out to them where they were. We were keeping in contact and finding out, making sure that nothing varied. And where we came across what we thought were anything different, or we saw quite a number of the enemy in a certain place, then we sent out a fighting patrol of a night time. And this was quite terrifying, going out in the dark, across territory which you were partly familiar with in the daytime, and which you'd clear that day from booby traps. And the object always was to get hold of prisoners. And it was never bloody easy, because if you've read all the books about the First World War, you know, or those things, when you read about them, how patrols used to pass each other in fields, and it was all night time, and everybody was on edge, and anything, you could all get captured. It was a terrifying thing, a fighting patrol. We did a lot of them. Nobody really relished them. People began to hope that they weren't on the list for a fighting patrol, although initially we couldn't get there quick enough. But as these 3 months went past and we had no relief, nothing to relieve the tension, it became quite frightening. And I remember on one particular occasion, I was taking this intelligence officer, I think, with some of his people, and our object was, if we could, silently to catch a couple of prisoners. And we were on one side of the hedge and Germans were on the other, and we thought we'd achieved our object. All we had to do now was to grab one of these people in silence and then make our way home, because to get one prisoner in a situation like that, you stood a chance of getting a lot of intelligence which you couldn't normally pick up by observation. But anyway, they opened fire suddenly on us as though we'd walked into an ambush, and the crescendo of fire from such a close range was bloody terrifying, especially as a couple of our people dropped right to start with. We were only a small patrol. And I remember that somebody had a stretcher and they put one of these fellows on the stretcher. The other fellow was a walking wounded fellow, and we couldn't go any further. A battle had started. All we could do was return fire and get out of it. They knew of our existence. We weren't a big fighting patrol like that. It was a patrol just to snaffle a couple of prisoners. A lot of it was futile, but it was worth the risk. But coming back, as we were running away, following these hedges in the main, again the mortars, they were marvellous on mortars. The Germans, who we just surprised, or had ambushed us, or had shot us up, started shelling exactly where we were as we were walking along. This wounded fellow on the stretcher, who two people had been struggling to carry, got off the belly stretcher and ran like hell. And he was quite badly wounded. But it just shows you what fright can do to you. Anyway, we got back from that, like we got back from other patrols. Another instance I'll mention in that time we were there, I mean, a couple of the books that are written, they talk about me being up trees, sniping and tied on with ropes and this sort of thing, but I don't.